House will make an offer to the Senate. And the first item on the agenda is testimony from DHS on the CCO or CCDS negotiations. And Brian Osberg will testify.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm Brian Osberg. I'm the state Medicaid director. I'm also responsible for healthcare purchasing for the Department of Human Services. As you know, we've entered into contracts with four healthcare systems, coordinated care delivery systems, four CCDSs this past week. Those contracts are publicly available. I just want to point out to the committee that in those contracts, there are conditions by which a CCDS can terminate with 30-day notice, and those provisions relate to the financing of the program. It also relate to material changes to eligibility or benefits or services provided through the program. And I can get into more detail on that, but I wanted to bring your attention to the committee that any proposals that you may have or considering that would materially change the program could potentially trigger a termination provision within one of the CCDS arrangements at their option. And I'm here prepared to explain or to discuss and answer questions regarding the terms of the contract at this point. I'd be glad to do that.
Mr. Osberg, if you could answer questions about how you fix the liability problem that they have.
Mr. Chairman, yes.
I have some questions that relates to page 24 of the GAMC bill says applicants and recipients may enroll in any available coordinated care delivery system statewide. And there's nothing in that sentence that relates to them limiting the number of people that can go into a particular.
Mr. Chairman, let me first explain how we developed the enrollment thresholds. For the benefit of the committee, the contracts provide for the ability for a CCDS to trigger a corrective action if they hit certain enrollment numbers within after 60 days of the contract going into place. Anytime after 60 days, if a certain enrollment threshold is hit by a CCDS, they can trigger a 30-day period by which we tried to bring that back within the threshold number.
And what was your legal authority to write a contract like that?
Mr. Chairman, the issue that you just stated, in fact, it says available coordinated care delivery system. Our interpretation of available means that available in terms of geographic availability is also the service capacity of a CCDS to serve a number of people. So we determined that given that term, available, meaning that the law anticipated that not all of our clients could be served by all CCDSs. So we developed a threshold, enrollment threshold for each of the CCDSs. And let me just tell you what those are, and I'll tell you how we did that. But our belief is that the term available allowed us to interpret this to suggest that a CCDS has limitations in terms of how many people they could serve throughout the state, excuse me, and also in terms of their physical capacity to serve all CCD or all GAMC clients. Hamilton County Medical Center, what we did is that we took the average enrollment for GAMC for the most recent quarter, which is 36,424. And we then factored what each of the CCDS's share of the GAMC payments were for the most recent year that we could record that, and that's 2008. That means that Hampton County Medical Center's enrollment threshold is 9,470. Regions is 3,424. Fairview University is 2,404. And North Memorial is 1,967. This totals to 17,265. All four of these CCDSs are in the metropolitan area. We were disappointed that we did not have more CCDSs participate. And I could talk about the fact that the terms of this contract would be available now September 1st for any other qualified CCDS.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Osberg, you know, the department hasn't been so very good lately in how they interpret the laws we write. And I would disagree with you that the word available means that there would be a limit on organizations that have signed contracts with you that would be available to people who would be in the GAMC program. That language was put in there to make sure that people would have choice if there was more than one available to them. That's what the word available meant, available to the enrollee, not vice versa. And I don't believe you have the authority to cap contracts. I'd like to know how many people that are not allocated to one of these organizations in terms of your cap there are left in the metropolitan area that potentially would be in the GMC program.
Mr. Osberg.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, we can get that number for you. We know how many.
You know what that number is today. Tell me now. It's like 47% of the population.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Berglund, for Hennepin and Ramsey County, the number, I believe, totals to be a little around 19,000. I don't have the exact number in front of me.
Well,
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, I do not believe this law was crafted to serve less than 80% of the population.
That's what it says.
And I believe the contracts that you've signed are limiting the population that would have access to a full range of services, and I don't believe that is what was intended by the law.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Berglund, the issue was that if we did not do this, we'd have no coverage for our clients beginning June 1st. We'd have no CCDS that would participate. Our understanding was that we were told and instructed to make sure that this works the best way possible for our clients, and this is the best we could do under the circumstances, given the challenging aspects of the law.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Osberg, if the law isn't workable, then we should rework the law, not rework the clients.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Berglund, I was not in a position to do that. I was in a position to implement the law that was in front of us.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Osberg, the department is always in a position to come back and ask for changes in the legislature, and you do it all the time.
Senator Solon, I think, was first, and then Senator Sharon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Osberg, why wasn't this the same option available to Greater Minnesota when they were struggling so hard to be able to implement a program that seemed to have endless boundaries and endless risk?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bretner Solon, that is a major and legitimate issue. We were unable during the last couple of days of negotiations to physically make this available to other CCDSs. We didn't have the capacity to negotiate with all their CCDSs at that point. The four CCDSs in play here came together as a collaborative to work with us, and we didn't have the time nor the capacity in terms of resources to extend this to the other 13 CCDSs. Those other 13 CCDSs will have the same arrangement available to them September 1st, so they'll miss out, that's true, in 3 months, but they have the option to participate under the same terms as provided in this arrangement on September 1st.
Senator Solon.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Mr. Osberg, it's very clear, though, in the legislation that it says that we are to provide geographic access to ensure that at least 80% of enrollees have access to a coordinated care delivery system. So negotiating with four hospitals in the metro area to cover, you know, 49 or 50% of the population is not following the legislation that was crafted.
Mr. Chair, Senator Prentice Solon, that provision says that gives us the authority to contract up to 80% of the JMC client enrollment. That's what that does. It gives us the authority to go beyond the 17 CCDSs. That's what that provision relates to, Senator. It's not instruct. That's not a.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Osberg, in any event, I mean, why is Greater Minnesota left to be a second-rate citizen? Why is there not equality that is provided for the whole state of Minnesota? I don't believe that this legislation was meant to be that way.
Mr. Chair, Senator Brenner Solon, no, it's not meant to be that way. We invited all 17 CCDSs to participate in a conference with us. Can you remember
Mr.
the time
Chair,
frame
Mr.
we had?
Mr. Osberg, they were not invited to be a part of this. They knew nothing about the contracting that you were undertaking during the past week with these other four hospitals.
Mr. Chair, Senator Prentner Solon, I'm going back to the point in which we began implementing the law. We invited all 17 CCDSs at that point to come and discuss the possibility. We explained what the process was going to be and how we're going to proceed. So we invited all of them to express interest in the possibility of entering into an arrangement.
And Mr. Chair, Mr.
Senator
Osberg,
Solon.
All hospitals expressed interest. Most felt that they could not accept the risk that was entailed with it. And so most opted out, and at least 16 have opted out at one time. So if a different arrangement were extended to one group of hospitals, it should have been extended to all hospitals.
Mr. Osborne.
Mr. Chair, Senator Prentice-Solon, that's a very legitimate issue. That will be extended to the other CCDSs September 1st.
That's not good enough.
Senator Sharon.
I got so absorbed by the conversation that I'm afraid I've lost track of what it was I was going
well,
to
we'll,
ask.
We have Murphy and Hosh next, so
you
can try to remember that.
Thank you.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Osberg, when we were in the thick of negotiating what resulted in the law that's been signed, we discussed at the start the need to identify the potential number of enrollees paired with the 17 CCDSs. And I remember explicitly waiting for the Department of Human Services to produce for us a geographic map, pairing what would be the apportioned number of enrollees to the 17 CCDSs that the department believed would sign up and participate in the system, giving it statewideness, giving us the opportunity for 80% of the enrollees to participate in the reform, and creating a limited uncompensated care pool for those hospitals that choose or would not have the capacity to do that. I did not prevail. A map was never produced. I was told that that was not necessary. And now, in order to make the reform work, the department has essentially unilaterally agreed to enrollee caps. While I understand the contracts are public documents, the legislature didn't intend that. We didn't participate in that. And the people who are going to lose in this equation are the enrollees that may not have a place to go. So I just want to be very clear that I understand, and I am grateful to the hospitals that have worked to try and make an arrangement so that at least some of the GMC enrollees will get care. I'm grateful for that. But as we're finishing our work this session, there is unfinished work around this issue that we are going to need to deal with. And the GMC bill, as it was signed into law, at this point is not achieving its intended goals.
Representative Hosh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I want to get back to some of the points Senator Solon was trying to address. 100% agree that many of our hospitals were not aware of any sort of that these negotiations were going on. Can you give me a timeline when the negotiations first commenced and when you started talking about enrollee caps?
Mr. Asper.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hosh, yes. It came clear to us about a week ago that there were not going to be any CCDSs willing to participate. At that time, we introduced the possibility, based on this term of available and how we interpreted that, we introduced the prospect of having enrollment thresholds. And so it was about a week ago that that took place. Again, remember, we had a time frame by which we had to have done this week by Thursday. We had to have done this arrangement in order to make sure that there was appropriate due process to our clients and informing them of all their options on June 1st. So the time frame was such that we needed to come to closure on these negotiations. So it was, I believe, last weekend that we introduced the notion of an enrollment threshold.
Representative Hosh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Osberg, who did you inform that you were considering enrollee caps of the 17 named potential CCSDs?
Mr. Osberg.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hosh, of course, that was proposed to us by the potential CCDSs, so we did not inform any other party of those discussions.
Representative Hosh.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Osberg, are you aware of, you know, what the main concerns of potential providers were, for instance, say St. Cloud or St. Mary's at Duluth Clinic, what their main concerns with the original GAMC reforms were?
Mr. Osberg.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hosh, I know it varied. I know one of the issues clearly was financial liability. All 17 CCDSs had issues and concerns about the financial liability associated with this arrangement. That was the most discussed concern that that all 17 CCDSs had.
Representative Hosh.
One last thing, Mr. Chair, and I think, you know, for something that transpired within the last week, that if other potential providers were informed of the possibility or informed of the road that you were going down, there may have been additional consideration outside of just the four or five that you've gone to contract with. And I don't think they should be punished with having to wait until September because they weren't informed of the subject of the negotiations that were going on. I think it's an unfortunate oversight.
Representative Abler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I begged my local hospital to submit an offer. I called up the commissioner and chatted and said, they're pretty reticent, they're nervous. He says, put a proposal together. We may not be able to take it, but they should put a proposal in. That's Mercy Hospital, one in just next door to my district, a couple blocks out of it. And I met with the administrator, the president, by phone, and urged him to cobble something together just to get into the mix. And I just have Mr. Osberg, there was a deadline of April 15th. By which a hospital had to apply, is that right?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Abler, that was the deadline which they had to express interest and to submit a proposal as to how they would provide covered services, that's right.
And I think you got, how many proposals were submitted?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Abler, we received four at that point.
Four. Mm-hmm. And were those four the ones that wound up doing
it? Mr. Chairman, Representative Abler, yes, the four that ended up negotiating and contracting with us.
And so it just seems to me, and so if they didn't, and they felt the pressure of this deadline, August, April 15th, and that's in the statute that if they couldn't apply, there was no extension available if they didn't put a proposal together.
Mr. Chairman, Representative
Abler,
there was no extension really on the issue of that submission. And then their original deadline for coming to closure was April 30th in terms of signing the contract. But that was extended to, as I said, to this past Thursday.
All right. So, Madam Chair and Mr. Chair and members, we're talking to a messenger here, and I'm actually kind of happy you got four deals put together. I wish my hospital would have been one of the ones in the mix. And four hospitals at least put together a proposal. All 17 could have, They didn't have to sign the deal, but all 17 should have put something together saying, we'd like to be in this, so we're concerned, but here's something we could do, knowing it's an offer, not a contract. And had they all, I think, I don't know, I didn't ask that, but I had the impression since they negotiated all four after they had got into who was going to be in the potential mix, that they would have negotiated all 17 to find out who could meet these terms. And you're getting chiropractic law now from me, but as I was reading in the, it's some of the language about this law is in the bill on R62 and 63 on line 60.7. This available word is there. Applicants and recipients may enroll in any available coordinated care delivery system statewide. I was just thinking, so what if only Hennepin County had been the one? And so now you're going to put 36,000-something people into Hennepin County. Let's pretend they could get there. How would they ever handle that kind of volume? And so they have a capacity that they can only handle so many people, and a physical capacity of, and also a business capacity. But even just if they all went there and lined up, I don't know where they'd even sit. I think that, I mean, just to be kind of this man who's passionate about our work, and he cares about this as much as anybody in the room, I'm interesting that, I mean, applicants may have any available coordinated care delivery system statewide. So if you're enrolled in a plan that can't take you because they're too full, well, what good is that? So I just wanted to, I think that, and see, you write words. We write words. We don't even know how they're going to be interpreted. And you can write anything you want on paper, but you still got to build it and make it operate. And so I just want to commend the innovation of this man to get 17,500 people in a system that otherwise there'd be nobody in. And they would all be sharing a $20 million pot based upon the law we passed that I voted for. So I guess it's not a question, just a comment.
Well, Mr. Abler, 13 hospitals thought that the law meant what it said. Four thought that the law did not mean what it said. Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Abler and Mr. Osberg, I understand that Mr. Osberg is a messenger, and we expect him to be a messenger in a two-way sense of the word. Mr. Osberg, what happens when somebody shows up in a hospital emergency room who would be eligible for this program, and the hospital's already met their cap? They would still have to serve that person, wouldn't they?
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, yes. And they know that. They've said that.
Senator Berglund.
So then what happens after that? Are they sent someplace else to get their follow-up care? Or if every hospital's at the cap, they just don't get any follow-up care?
Mr. Osberg.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, if all four CCDSs are at the cap, the GMC client who's not enrolled in a CCDS would not have access to one. That's true. And they would then have, as the legislation anticipated, they would have the pharmacy arrangement, and they also have chemical dependency coverage through the county, and then they would receive hospital care from a hospital, and which would be paid for through the uncompensated care pool. That's what's available for those who are not enrolled in a CCDS.
So they take. Well, Mr. Osberg, we never anticipated that a hospital organization that would be a CDDS would also be drawing money out of an uncompensated care pool.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, no, they would not be eligible for the uncompensated care pool. A CCDS who has their limit would not be eligible for the CCDS pool for any emergency services or for any hospital services.
Well, Mr. Senator Chairman Berglund. And Mr. Osberg, I don't believe when we drafted the law and we voted for the law that we anticipated that there would be people who would be in a service area of a hospital that agreed to participate in this program that would be turned away from receiving services. In fact, the law itself says if you take money and participate in being anything in the law, you can't turn people away. So how is it that somebody could show up at a hospital that signed a contract with you to be a part of this law, and then they can see them in their emergency room and then not provide follow-up care to them?
Mr. Osberg.
How can they turn somebody away for that care?
Mr. Chair and Senator Berglund, we don't anticipate that will happen, that they will provide care to that person, but it would be uncompensated care. and they will do whatever they think they need to in order to make sure the person gets either direct them to maybe another organization that does still accepting clients in their CCDS. The hospital, we talked about that scenario, and the hospital is prepared, the CCDS is prepared to make sure that client gets the care necessary, and they realize that they would not be eligible through the uncompensated care pool for any services that they provide. But they will do what they do today, and that is make sure, for anybody who's uninsured, that's make sure that they get the care they need.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Osberg. What is the individual eligible for? The individual under the law is eligible to apply for and be enrolled in the GAMC program. They're not eligible to receive uncompensated care.
Mr. Osberg.
Again, Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, they are eligible for, as we talked about, the pharmacy benefit and the services provided through the county and the chemical dependency fund. And also, they're eligible to receive hospital care, which would be paid for through the uncompensated care pool. It's true that under this scenario, not everyone would be eligible for the CCDS arrangement, potentially. At this point, the law anticipated that everyone would be enrolled in the CCDS by even suggesting that what the department needed to do is look at the possibility of contracting with additional CCDSs to cover 80% of the enrollment. The 17 CCDSs really composed about 70% of the GMC expenses. So the law anticipated that not everyone will have access to a CCDS.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Osberg, the law anticipated that if you lived in a service area of a hospital that signed a contract with you to be a coordinating care organization, that individual would have access to that service. And there is no authority in the law for you to cap people or tell people you can enroll in GMC, but you don't get the benefit set that's available to your neighbor who signed up last week.
Senator Solem is next, and then Senator Sharon.
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Osberg, you just indicated that the application date was extended to Thursday. Isn't it true that some of the larger hospitals in greater Minnesota, particularly in the regional centers, have had significant inquiry asking how they could work out the liability issues and the population issues and how they could control the parameters so that they could participate? And isn't it also true that as recently as Wednesday, SMDC from Duluth inquired of you about how they could still continue to talk about being a participant?
Mr. Chair, Senator Pretner Solon, I did receive one inquiry, and that is from St. Mary's Duluth Clinic, asking about what's going to happen now that Hennepin County Medical Center was not going to participate. I did not receive any suggestion that they would like to discuss this with us at all. That was the question posed to me, is what are you going to do now, given that St. Mary's Duluth or the Hennepin County Medical Center was not going to participate, based
Chair,
on action reported, Hennepin County Board action reported in the paper, I believe.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Osberg, given that inquiry, and since Hennepin County was negotiating, did it not seem pertinent or appropriate for you to contact them and indicate that you were changing the conditions of participation?
Mr. Chair, Senator Pretner Solon, I was not in a position to discuss the status of our negotiations with other parties, with anybody else.
Just so you were only allowed to make those contract arrangements with those four hospitals.
Chair, Senator Pretner Solon, that was their only opportunity. Given the time frame we had, that was the only opportunity we had was to get this deal done. And we did not have, as I mentioned before, it's unfortunate, very unfortunate. We did not have the time or the capacity to extend this arrangement to others. I agree with that. That would have been best. We're not able to do that. In order to meet the time frame to make sure our clients have information available to them for the new June 1 effective date changes, we had to do what we needed to do to make sure somebody was available to serve our clients. And this was the best we could do under the circumstances.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you very much. I would want to say that not only did I not think that you had the time to do this, I don't think you had the authority to do it with other hospitals, nor the hospitals with whom you have made this arrangement. So it wasn't an issue of a time. It's an issue of your authority to do this. Setting that aside for a moment, I would ask, is the 10% additional reimbursement rate still in place for coordinating care for these hospitals that you've now set a cap on?
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, yes, certain facilities were able to receive a 10% increase in the payment. It was Tampa County Medical Center, Regions, and I want to say Fairview University. North Memorial was not eligible for that. That was prescribed in law that they had a 10% bump, if you will, in terms of the CCDS payment. And that did play out.
Thank you. My point about that is that when you're talking about what the reasoning is for why hospitals participated, we're talking not only about risk, but the risk was even higher for rural hospitals because not only did they not have a cap or know how many persons they would be obligated to serve, because they have to coordinate the care for all the other care providers in the area, they were also not given an additional resources in order to even contribute to what losses there would be for them in trying to coordinate all of that care. So the rural part of the state has had not just a matter of a question about the size or the volume of work they'd be obligated for. We did not provide for them in the legislation to actually do the work of coordinating all of that care. So what you are doing here, which I think is unauthorized by law, and I think that the department, or at least this administration, has a demonstrated history of over-interpreting their authority within the law, which I believe they've done again here, has created a situation in which they have made it even more difficult for persons who are eligible by criteria for this program but restricted from access. We haven't really met the letter of the law in terms of accessibility. We have restricted accessibility for persons who meet the criteria for being eligible for this program. So, and in addition to that, I would like to say that in the debate about this in the beginning, this is not an unanticipated consequence. There was a debate and there was discussion that if the hope and the dream that these 17 hospitals would not actually be able to participate because the risk was too high, the reimbursement was too low, and that there wasn't administrative costs for the rural parts of the state to be able to carry this out, that it would result in maybe one major metropolitan hospital, HCMC, being like the Vets Hospital, where everybody who had those privileges would be going there. This is not a surprise, because it was underfunded, and it is still underfunded. And now we have divided the funding stream so that only those that are in these can draw down the dollars, and everybody else in the state draws from the smaller $20 million pool. So we are creating a bigger problem for a significant portion of the state, not a help. This is not helpful, except for this a very special few that will be able to get their costs reimbursed when the entire state is paying the tab on this. It isn't just those communities, those geographic areas that are paying the tab on this. It's a statewide contribution to solve a problem related to people who are very poor.
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, that was a very good summary of the situation, in my opinion. Thank you.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question was on the dollar amounts that are going to be spent are going to be encumbered under these contracts of the $71 million. Do you know how much is encumbered here?
Mr. Chair, Representative
Maybe I
Thiessen.
Missed that. I'm sorry.
No, I did not cover that. Yes, it will be distributed, again, to those four CCDSs as the law prescribes. And Hempa County Medical Center would get 56%, Regions 20%, Fairview University 14%, and North Memorial 10%.
Mr. Chair, of the
Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, of the $71 million over a 13 or 12-month period.
So, Mr. Chair, how can people come in September then?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, what happens is that somebody comes in to, into September, that money will be reallocated. Okay. This is done on a quarterly basis. We're not paying them on a yearly basis. We'll reallocate on a quarterly basis.
Okay, so, Mr. Chair, so if someone new comes in, then Hennepin County would get a smaller share.
Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, that's right.
And, Mr. Chair, is their contract acknowledge that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, yes.
Okay.
And, Mr. Osberg, I don't know if you have the bill there, but it also says that the coordinated care delivery system is required to deliver all the care unless there is an emergency and this person shows up in another hospital, then the CCDS has to pay this other hospital for the treatment. Is that still in place?
Mr. Chair, the law it states that very thing, that they CCDSs have to provide emergency services, whether it's within their CCDS or their network of providers or outside. The contract is silent as to the financial terms of that arrangement. That that is between the CCDS and that non-CCDS hospital in terms of what payment, if any, is made available.
Well, couldn't the, let's suppose somebody shows up in Unity Hospital in, is that in your district, Abler?
No, it's Fridley.
Close. And they're assigned to HCMC, and they get $400,000 worth of medical care for some tremendous emergency. How is that shift of money going to go from HCMC to Unity Hospital?
Mr. Chair, that is between HCMC and Unity Hospital as to the terms by which payment would be made.
Representative Abler.
You just described one of the liability issues. Mr. Chair.
Representative Abler.
I'm just, I don't know, I've been reading this some more, and I, you know, I didn't, this, when this came forward, this was negotiated with some depth of work, a great deal of depth of the part of the two chairs here and some others. And when it came out, it was, we didn't spend a lot of time in committee on it. It was to be done, and it didn't go through policy. It went through finance, and then it was mostly testimony. But for some reason, on 60.7 on the R62, that the word available was put in after the word any. No, but that's in the, no, I just underlined available. Okay. I just underlined available, so thanks. But for some reason, when you were writing this, you put the word available in there instead of just any. So, I mean, it's, sometimes words have more impact than you know. I just was thinking about the Minnesota Care Law. I wasn't here then, Senator Berglund, but I would predict that the next year after you did it, there was a fix-up chunk because it wasn't quite what you meant and it wasn't working maybe as well. I know it, under my watch, we've amended it many times to handle some foreseen or unforeseen problem that's come up. And I remember at the hearing when we were hearing from the hospitals about how this was going to work and who was going to go, who wasn't. St. Mary's came up and said they weren't going to go, and I was deeply disappointed about that. I chastised Alina for not even trying. And I was disappointed. That's my area. I just thought they would kind of pile on and serve the north chunk there. And lucky for my folks, they could get down to north now because that's not terribly far. They can catch a bus or I don't know how they're going to get there. But Mercy was a nice little chunk on the north end of town, could serve Elk River, St. Francis, and that region around there with, you know, several hundred people that probably go there. But I'm just questioning about this capacity thing. You said there's some 19,000 people in Hennepin and Ramsey County.
Mr. Chair, approximately 19,000 today, yes.
And I wonder if you extend the 25-mile thing around to include my area. I got to think that it's still not 30,000, and some are statewide. But, you know, I mean, this is a work in progress. You know, it came out of, Senator, I realize you're frustrated and you're, you know, but some of the hospitals that didn't participate, they didn't send in a piece of paper saying, we want to try, here's some back of the napkin ideas, we'd like to give it a shot. That would have got him in the door. but they were thinking this expansion was going to happen. And I heard that clearly as they came and testified. We tried this, but we want the expansion. And but they can come in September as a full participant under this deal if they want. In the meantime, they got $20 million to share. This whole pot of people is going to share a quarter or 4/13 of $71 million, which is about $18 million between the four of them. The uncompensated care pot's $20 million. When it's gone, it's gone. But if those hospitals that didn't participate spend that money, they're going to be fully, they'll be in just as good as the people that are in. And they're going to want to get in September to get the pot of money that's left. That's how I see it. And plus the $45 million drug pot. So I'm just trying to encourage us all to celebrate the small victory and think that the 18,000 people statewide that are yet uncovered in a plan still have considerable access to the uncompensated care pots. I'm done. I just wanted to offer a positive side if I could find one.
Thank Mr. You. Chair, Representative Abel, I want to make it clear that the law does give us discretion to enter into arrangements going forward. We would clearly enter into arrangements with CCDSs in the non-metro area because we need more access. However, in the metropolitan area, we would give some thought as to what impact not only would there be for our clients, but also impact would be on the current CCDSs. In terms of a business relationship with those four CCDSs, we would give some consideration as to what the impact would be on that. Outstate, clearly, we would want and welcome all comers. But I really appreciate the fact that these four CCDSs came forward and willing to negotiate in terms with us. And so we will give thought as to whether or not it's in the interest of our clients and our partners to expand it within the metropolitan area.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, I'll just follow. So Mercy might not even be allowed in, but certainly St. Cloud and Duluth would be, and Bemidji would
Mr.
be welcome.
Chair, that Representative April, yes, that's right.
Senator Solon.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I really don't want to prolong the conversation because being a part of it is the lesser of two evils. I mean, the participants are lucky if they get 23% of costs. It's just that it's better than getting nothing. But I think the more patients you get, the deeper in debt you get. Unfortunately, it's a bad deal. We just have to find something, and the expansion of the Medicaid would be a much better deal for the patient and for the provider.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Abler, I just wanted to clarify the words "any available." That meant that we were not going to draw geographic boundaries around hospitals. Because maybe if you live in St. Cloud and you have suffered a terrible burn, you might want to be treated at Regions or Hennepin where they specialize in taking care of people like that. So any available meant any available on a statewide basis.
I see one.
Well, I was going to just say that that the hope that the others will participate, remember, we have not got the same conditions, even in the old, even before this negotiated contract, for the other hospitals that were identified as potentially able to enter into these contracts to cover their costs of coordinating care. So to sit around here and act as if it's maybe now that this deal has been offered to these four hospitals, maybe we ought to offer the deal, then it's got to be the whole deal, which includes the costs of being actually having to carry out all the responsibilities of being one of these coordinating care organizations.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Osberg, for your testimony.
Thank you.
Okay, and we have Chief Niall Zygmunt to talk about something in the House bill relating to firefighters.
Are we following this agenda?
And we're skipping to number 7. That's a good one.
Is he here?
There he is. Come on up.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. Didn't want to intrude.
A little bit out of order, but the agenda. But we want to get you on your way. Welcome to the committee,
Mr. Chairman, members. Thank you, Niall Zickman, representing the Minnesota State Fire Chiefs Association. I am a fire chief from Spring Lake Park, Blaine Mounsey, which is predominantly a volunteer department. I do sincerely appreciate having the time and the opportunity to share with you a little bit about the volunteer fire service in the state. 800 departments. 20,000 firefighters, of which 18,000 are volunteers. The state of Minnesota ranks 47th in the nation on per capita firefighter expenditure. We're a very efficient fire service, and it's in large part due to those dedicated, you know, volunteers that take the time to go through pretty significant training and also the response. 2 years ago, the Department of Public Safety conducted a recruitment and retention study, as like other states in the nation, we continue to struggle with attracting new individuals, predominantly because of the significant training that has to occur, but in part also because of the demographics. 75% of our people are over the age of 35. And as we did those, we held meetings and hearings around the state and try to identify some of those things that could be leveraged, efficient, if you will, to help recruit and retain volunteers. And one of those items was providing health care to those volunteer firefighters. And so the provision that we're talking about would apply to those volunteers if they don't have another insurance source, and then they'd have the opportunity to go into MinCare. And I guess in terms of how many people would take advantage of this, and I can only speak specifically to my own department, but as a rule, pretty high standards for physical fitness, as you can imagine, for volunteer firefighters. So as a group, you know, I think we're pretty healthy. For example, in my department, if you get injured, you can't return to service until the doctor gives you a complete bill of health. Even if you just have a sprained ankle, if the doctor says you can't lift 200 pounds and carry your pack, we're just not going to release you. So those things that may typically allow you to serve another job performance, you know, typically won't. And most fire departments will have a original recruitment and retention agility test, and then they'll have a full physical. So I guess I just kind of, you know, like to pause there, and I don't know if OJ is going to share some words, or I'll answer questions.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you. My name is OJ Doyle. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Ambulance Association. I'm a retired nationally registered paramedic, and our association spends a considerable amount of time working on issues pertinent to recruitment and retention. 62% of all ambulance personnel in the state of Minnesota are volunteer, and we're losing roughly 2 to 3 ambulance services a year, volunteer services. Because of demographics, aging population, it is, as Niall was saying, it's strenuous. It's hard on your back. It's leaving Christmas dinner to go out and respond to car accidents, middle of the night for heart attacks. It is stressful. And we have worked with the fire service in trying to address means of recruiting and retention retaining volunteers. And it's getting tougher, and we keep trying to look for carrots, but the reality of the financial situation with the state, we all realize how difficult it is in the decisions you're trying to make. But this 2006 task force that now referred to, we held hearings around the state. We paid all the costs for the study, and the hearing was not done with state money. And the number one comment on what would be positive in helping to recruit and retain volunteers is access to Health Insurance Minnesota Care for those who did not have it. I understand the fiscal note on this is somewhere between $62,000 and $68,000. I don't know a lot of the other specifics on the implementation. We feel that this would help hold on to people. Not addressing the fire piece of this, but just the ambulance. We lose our volunteers, which we are doing rapidly. It's going to increase the cost to the healthcare system in Minnesota between $50 and $60 million a year minimum. So we're trying to hold off that and enhance cost. And sorry for taking so much time. Thank you very much.
Any questions? Okay, thank you for your testimony. And
I sent some emails.
Thank you, Chair. Members, appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Okay, we're going to skip down to number three, which is the Senate proposal for CPEA to DISH. And we want to hear from David Godfrey from Hennepin County, and then any comments from the Department of Human Services.
Mr. Chair, members, for the record, my name is David Godfrey from Hennepin County Medical Center. The proposal in the Senate position is to use certified public expenditures to be used as a match to draw down DISH funds that currently have been left on the table by the line item veto of GAMC. And that are currently being used to fund part of the GAMC program. Certified public expenditures are essentially the uncompensated care and the public program underpayments that are costs to public hospitals. And so Regions and HCMC are the two hospitals that can actually certify their expenditures and have them matched by DISH for DISH. And I should say from the outset that HCMC supported the limited use of CPEs to help finance the GAMC proposal, and we also support its use for Medicaid expansion. We would have difficulty using those CPEs to match DISH dollars if the DISH dollars were just to be used for general fund budget balancing. Currently, and I think DHS can speak more to the fiscal implications of this, but essentially we believe that we have sufficient CPEs at the present time to draw down the full amount of $35 million a year that's available for DISH dollars. In terms of what that picture looks like in a Medicaid expanded environment, I think DHS can speak to that, but essentially we will still, Regions and HCMC still have uncompensated care and public program underpayments in an environment with Medicaid expansion to 75% of poverty. So we'd anticipate that there would be some CPEs available to draw down DISH dollars, and what that amount is, I'm not sure, but perhaps DHS can comment on that.
Okay, questions for Mr. Godfrey? Okay, DHS? Two Davids in a row.
Mr. Chair, Dave Greenman with the Department of Human Services. We did some analysis of this proposal by the Senate, and we agree with Mr. Godfrey that under a no MA expansion proposal, there would be enough CPEs to claim the DISH money in 12 and 13 that the Senate is tracking. We did some analysis of what it would look like under a MA expansion, and we were, I think, I'm not sure exactly how this happened, but the information got late to Mr. Albrecht, and we apologize for that. George Hoffman and some of our rates policy staff looked into this, and based on the information we have from Hennepin County's, I believe it's their accountant or somebody who works with tracking the numbers, it looks like based on their calendar year 08 numbers, they have about $55.3 million in losses. And when you back out the GAMC losses under an MA early expansion proposal, the losses actually decreased by, I believe it looks like about $44 million. And in addition to that, there's also the losses would be further reduced because you're putting people what you currently count as losses can also include the Minnesota Care payments to adults without kids. When you put those people on medical assistance, those are counted as revenues. So the losses decrease further from that. And also there's also a decrease in losses because some of the currently uninsured population would be going on medical assistance. So what our analysis from our folks is that there would be no additional DSH to claim in 12 and 13 under an MA early expansion proposal.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Greenman, does that also take into account the reductions that we're making in the bill, both to Minnesota Care payments and to managed care payments?
Mr. Greenman.
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, I think I'd have to get some more information about that. We're happy to continue to work with Mr. Godfrey on this.
Mr. Godfrey?
Mr. Chair, also I'd just like to add that as you add more people to Medicaid, that would increase our Medicaid losses in underpayments for those individuals. And I'm not sure that that's been taken into account here.
So, Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Greenman, I just don't think that the department has a claim to make that the original fiscal note that we got is in error. I just have to say that, you know, what you're telling me right now is you're not sure what you're telling us. So until we get a different fiscal note that tells us something different than the fiscal note we already have, we have to go by the fiscal note we've got.
Okay.
And I might just say, with less than a day left to, you know, finish this conference committee, it's getting a little bit late to be giving us new fiscal notes.
So, Mr. Greenman, if you could get that as quickly as possible to us, we would appreciate it. And Representative Thiessen.
Thanks. And I haven't seen that fiscal note. Was that based on the early MA expansion or under current GMC?
Excuse me, Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, I think I'd have to find a little bit more about what fiscal note the senator is referring to as well.
Senator Berglund, what fiscal note are you referring to?
I think it's the one you have in your hand there.
This isn't actually a fiscal note, sorry.
It was either a fiscal note or communication from George Hoffman.
And maybe Senator Berglund, since Davis or Mr. Greenman wasn't part of that conversation, was that based on early MA expansion, or was it based on when the GMC deal was under consideration?
Mr. Hoffman was aware that we were discussing both early expansion and CPEs as elements of our bill.
So this is a, Mr. Chair, so this is a conversation you had?
It was a request for information.
Did you get written paper?
Yes.
Could we see that?
We will dig it up.
Well,
there's some more, there looks like there's some more information.
Well, the amounts are in our forecast. The amounts are in the forecast that we received as well.
Mr. Chair, can you explain what you mean? What forecast are you talking about? In your spreadsheet?
No. The forecast for DSH.
Mr. Chair, which forecast for DSH? Maybe, and I'm sorry, I don't know, I should know your name.
Dennis,
yeah.
Mr. Chair and Representative Thiessen, my understanding is that the amounts on our spreadsheet are the amounts that are reflected in the February forecast for DSH payments.
And Mr. Chair, at that point, there was no discussion of MA expansion because it didn't exist yet.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Thiessen, there was also no new GAMC program or anything else.
Fair point. So, if the CPE payments are based on this February forecast before anything has happened, it seems like we probably do need to get, I don't know how you can rely on that fiscal note either. I think we probably need to get a fiscal note from the department. I mean, if we're talking about fake numbers, we got to be you know, on a, I acknowledge fakeness on both sides of the aisle, I suppose. I mean, and the other thing, Mr. Chair, is Mr. Gottfried, who was a part of coming up with this analysis, acknowledged that Hennepin County has no idea what the number would be.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, in working with Hennepin County Medical Center and Regents Hospital, we know they have enough CPEs to claim the DISH money. We know the number for the DISH money. So there isn't as much that isn't known here as one would think there is.
Well, Mr. Chair, Mr. Gottfried just said that he didn't know what MA expansion was going to mean for it. I mean, that's what he just said.
Mr. Godfrey.
Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, I would just add to that really I think my point was we don't know what assumptions DHS would make about that. They're the ones, the keepers of the DHS forecast, and they know what other kind of elements they're expecting to see in an MA expanded kind of world. And so we don't have the capability. We can give them what our uncompensated care is prospectively going into next year. We don't know what assumptions they're making about the more global MA expanded universe.
So, Mr. Chair.
Representative Thiessen.
So are your assumptions on the $55 million based on an MA expansion?
The $55 million, Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, the $55 million is what we're looking at going into next year in terms of what we expect in terms of uncompensated care. And so, no, the answer is, we're not factoring in MA expansion. We'd expect them to do that because they're the ones who have the expertise in that area.
And Mr. Chair, you would expect that uncompensated care, if we were to do MA expansion, to be lower than the $55 million and probably by a fairly significant
amount. Mr. Godfrey.
Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, yeah, that's correct. That's I alluded to that in my initial comments, that we do acknowledge it would have some impact on the amount of uncompensated care HCMC and regions would see. It does have some offsets in terms of our underpayments as well. We don't know what those would be in terms of the assumptions DHS forecasting staff is making.
And Mr. Chair, and I understand you acknowledged that before. I need to reiterate that apparently. Okay.
Mr. Greenman, if you could get us sort of a formal fiscal note on this as quickly as possible, we would appreciate it.
Mr. Chair, we'd be happy to do that. I assume that's a request.
Yes.
Okay. What I can tell you is, I mean, I think just to clarify, what we have is the Hennepin County and Region's claimable losses from the data that we've received from them. We have, as Mr. Albrecht said, the available DISH funding from the February forecast, and that's money that's not currently being claimed, that we don't project to be claimed in 12 and 13. And we need to take a look at those two numbers and look at what we assume is going to happen to those claimable losses under an MA early expansion proposal. And as Senator Berglund said, we do need to include all of the other interactions that are going to be going on in the bill with the different rate changes and other things as well.
Representative Thiessen.
And Mr. Chair, and I think it would be helpful when the next exchange of spreadsheets happen, that since we don't have any actual real numbers on this, that the Senate's proposal actually acknowledges that fact and includes no money from CP at this point.
Okay. Thank you both for your testimony. Now we're going to go to...
And Mr. Chair, just because the Senate's demanding real numbers from us, yeah. I think it's fair is fair.
Okay, we have a spreadsheet and a one. Where's that one? One page sheet where the House is going to make an offer, and the House spreadsheet removes the tax revenue from the FLCs and tax havens. That's $156.3 million, and we make a number of offsetting cuts, which are listed below that, total up to that $156.3 million. And Mr. Walls, if you want to go through the changes.
Mr. Chair. Chair, if members have a spreadsheet, I believe, which is dated 5-8-2010 at 1:30 this afternoon, I will begin on page 2, line 102. The House is now including the CD provider rate reduction to match up with the Senate's provision. Mr. Chair, the next change would be on page 4, and that is an increase in TANF refinancing of $5 million. And, Mr. Chair, there it was something that was left out of the spreadsheet, and that is on page 5, line 299. The $4 million reduction should go to 9. This is for supported work, and this would be the extra $5 million that is reflected in the increased TANF refinancing. Mr. Chair, moving on to page 6, line 367. All revenue from FOCs and tax havens have been removed. Mr. Chair, going down to page 8, line 512. The House has increased the inpatient rate to hospitals to 6%. Excuse me, Mr. Chair, I believe it's 5%, and that is effective in fiscal 2011. And, Mr. Chair, on line 522, the House has included the hospital surcharge proposed by the Senate. Continuing on to page 9, line 593, the House includes a Senate provision for DHS operating budget reductions in fiscal years 12 and 13. Mr. Chair, continuing on to the very top of page 10, the House includes the delay of essential community services grants and tracks an additional $950,000. And, Mr. Chair, I believe the final change is on line, is on page 14, line 940. The House also includes some additional money for a fiscal 12 and 13 operating reduction to the Department of Health. That would conclude all the House proposed changes.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, since the Senate didn't really have any input into putting this agenda that you prepared for us together today, we'd just like to indicate that we'd like to at some point take testimony from providers who would be affected by the surcharge in regard to, you know, when does a surcharge stop becoming a revenue-raising mechanism from the Medicaid program and become a revenue-raising program from them. And, you know, at this point in time, we would like to hear both from the hospitals and the HMOs about that in regard to this House proposal.
That would be fine if there's people from the Hospital Association. What's the nearest bathroom? Welcome to the committee, Ms. Krinke.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mary Krinke, and I'm with the Minnesota Hospital Association. As you all know, surcharges are redistributive in their nature, and so it does have a different impact on different members of the Hospital Association. We have looked at this, and you do have to put it in context of the rest of the bill. And our association has looked at this and recognizes that the surcharge is a mechanism for leveraging new federal money back to Minnesota. So in the Senate proposal, what they do is they collectively, the hospitals would be paying in an additional $83 million in surcharges. That money, in essence, is split in half, with half of the money going to help with the state's bottom line and help offset the target that you all have to meet. And then money is put back into the Medicaid program, in essence, then to help the hospitals offset that surcharge. Hospitals were looking at the surcharge as a way to help avoid the cuts that that the governor had in his budget. So we come to the surcharge reluctantly, but recognize that the goal here is to leverage additional federal money back to Minnesota. So with the new House offer that was just offered a couple minutes ago, that, in essence, doesn't sit very well with the hospital community, because, in essence, you're taking the surcharge but still doing the ratable reductions. So it's not then a trade-off for us. It is getting both the bad medicine but still remaining sick.
So. And then the Ms. Krinke, in the Senate proposal, it's the surcharge, did you say $23 million?
No, it's $83 million. The surcharge is 80. Collectively, the hospitals would be paying in $83 million. And that is the first year. The Senate bill has the surcharge. The hospitals currently pay a surcharge of 1.56%. And the Senate proposal raises that to 2.63, and then it drops down to 2.3. And that would raise, in the first year, $83 million.
And what's the federal match?
Well, and for the first portion, as you all know, we're under $1.50, and then it drops down back to $1. So the match is on the surcharge. So the surcharge is used as a mechanism to bring in additional federal dollars.
Mr. Chairman, we have had this chart that we've wanted you to look at in terms of the various items that constitute how we make the hospitals whole again, and that's why we haven't gone beyond this in terms of making any additional cuts, because we believe the hospitals have done their fair share of helping us by helping us bring in this federal money, and we have done our responsibility in terms of making them as whole making them whole as a community and making each hospital as whole as possible.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Thiessen.
Ms. Krinke, do you consider the delay in the rebasing a cut?
Ms. Krinke.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is by far the biggest challenge that we have as we compare these two bills. And Representative Thiessen is correct in that the hospitals do look at the delayed rebasing as a cut to hospitals, primarily hitting us in the next biennium. It would be our hope, because the rebasing process updates the rates, and you look at what has changed in terms of service lines, in terms of poverty levels in different communities, the rebasing allows you to move your rates forward. As you all know, right now, hospital payments are based on 2002 costs, and a lot has changed since then. It would be our hope, if the committee were so inclined, to move forward with some type of rebasing, even if it was phased in, even if we did rebasing at 10% of the costs or something, so that we could at least have that process move forward. But the ratable stays with you. Regretfully, if we look at what has happened with previous rate cuts, they are all still in place. So we are very nervous about having a 6% rate cut on the books. Right now we're at 14.4%. So adding another 6% to that would bring rate cuts up to over 20%. So we're reluctant, very reluctant, to have a new ratable reduction that would put our rates at 20% below our 2002 cost.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Thiessen, our delay in rebasing is to be able to afford to do the early buy-in. And we believe hospitals benefit from having the early buy-in substantially, and so and even though the hospitals may view the delay in rebasing as a cut, everybody has to acknowledge that it is money that nobody has actually received yet. So,
Mr. Chair.
Representative Thiessen.
And I 100% agree with you that cuts to hospitals are going to be offset by the early option. My understanding is the delay in the rebasing is about $103 million hit to hospitals. What we're proposing in our bill is about an $85 million hit to hospitals. So, I mean.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Berglund.
And I just, main point. Go ahead.
Again, you know, when someone hasn't received something yet, they haven't exactly worked it into their financial plan. And we believe that it's less difficult for hospitals to delay getting something that they don't have yet than to get something removed from their budgets that they actually are budgeting for.
Okay. Any other?
Mr. Chairman and members, if there are technical questions that you all would like to ask of the Hospital Association regarding how the surcharge mechanism works and the different payback buckets, I can either do that here, or I could have an offline conversation. If there are questions regarding how the Senate structures the surcharge mechanism. So.
Representative Abler.
Thanks. And just to that point, can you just give a short thing about winners and losers? And I mean, the federal money, the federal chips in something, but are there some net people that wind up paying, some groups, private pay, et cetera? Oh, that's the sheet.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Abler, we have this chart that was put together by the Hospital Association, and I think it's pretty self-explanatory except for one thing, and that is that all of the hospitals that have the yellow coding are critical access hospitals, and those hospitals get to subtract the surcharge from their Medicare report. So for these hospitals, they get somewhere between 40 and 70% of the surcharge offset. And so if you see, the numbers at the end do not include that, because we couldn't factor, you know, which hospital had 40, which had 70. It depends on their Medicare mix with their other payers. But there is no private pay impact of this.
Okay. And Mr. Chair.
Representative Abler.
Maybe I just can restate the question. I appreciate the impact on hospitals. I was even thinking a different part. But those who actually go to a hospital and buy the services, will anybody notice that in their prices? Is that noticed, or is that just all some behind-the-scenes thing that nobody notices?
Ms. Cranky.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the surcharge, in essence, I'm going to go back to your first question, if I can. The larger percentage of government payer that you have, particularly in the Medicaid program, the surcharge would tend to help you more because the buckets of payment go back into your the way the payoff mechanism works. So for a hospital that had less government payer, the surcharge, in essence, you might be paying more in than you were getting back out. So how do hospitals handle this? Just like any other cost, it's spread throughout the hospitals. They try to negotiate with the plans to get paid better. They try to pass it or cost shift. But ultimately, some of the costs are either absorbed or passed on to other payers.
And so just to
Representative Abler.
I think I found the question I should ask. For 3M, who is a large self-insured company, are they going to have a little rate increase because of this?
Mr. Chair, members, it is doubtful that a surcharge of this amount would dramatically impact the prices that a 3M would pay.
Thank you.
Okay, and then thank you for your testimony, and I think next we have the health plans.
Members of the committee, my name is Catherine Commit from the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. And regarding the MA surcharge, we have serious concerns about the increase in the MA surcharge, and particularly in relationship to the development last night where the payback was removed will be very problematic in a couple of ways. One, that additional surcharge simply gets shifted to those who purchase health insurance. So it will be shifted, and it's only in the fully insured market. So it gets shifted directly to small employers and individuals who purchase in the fully insured market. Without the payback, that further complicates things because, as I believe Ms. Krinke was suggesting, there could be problems or will be problems with drawing down additional federal matching dollars.
Why is it just, if you're paying this out, why, if you're going to raise your rates to the small market and the self-insured, which I agree, why wouldn't you also raise it to the self-insured?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the self-insured members or employers that the health plans serve are the health plans only charge them an administrative fee to.
May I have your attention, please?
Now, does that mean we get to leave?
Yeah, right. Well, Ms. Schmidt, I've been here 18 years. That's the first time I've heard that.
There's no tourists here, I guess.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, to your question about how the self-insured portion of the business works, the health plans serve as the administrators for the health insurance plan for large employers, and so they don't deal with the claim. They don't carry the risk for the large employers. That is borne by the large employers themselves. They simply administer the benefits on behalf of the large employers. And so there's no way to pass that through because they are the ones bearing all the risk with the exception of the administrative costs. It's very concerning looking at this issue and then combining it with all of the other rate decreases and additional cuts and withholds makes it very difficult for the plans to pass through. They will have to pass it through, but I can assure you it will result in more people becoming uninsured and the cost of insurance going up dramatically. And for some of my plans, it could mean serious financial problems for them, especially plans that only serve government programs, because they're simply not able to pass it through to the commercial market. They don't have a commercial market.
Ms. Commit, what impact will the early expansion have on the amount of money that the health plans are going to be provided with?
Mr. Chair, I really don't have an answer to that question. I don't know. I haven't looked at that very carefully, and we could have some individual plans come up and speak to that if you would like.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Ms. Commit, even before the House took back their rate increases and other things to offset the HMO surcharge, I was concerned about the level of the surcharge that they had in comparison with the rate increases that they provided. Their rate increases were just slightly less than what the Senate had, and we have, of course, a much, much, much lower surcharge in our side on the bill. Were you concerned about that as well?
Senator Berglund, Mr. Chair, and members, yes, we're concerned. The surcharge poses a less of a burden in the Senate file 2337 than in the House file version. Nevertheless, it's still the same problem. It's just a matter of volume. But it's still the same types of problems where we will have to pass it through. to small employers and individuals, and it, that will be very difficult for those plans that have government programs. And I might also add that just following up to Ms. Krinke's comments, as the hospitals have to absorb all these cuts and surcharges and rate decreases and things like that, they will get shifted back to the health plan because the hospitals do negotiate very hard with the health plans, and they will negotiate higher rates to overcome the losses they receive through these cuts in government programs. So it's compounded by these additional cuts that would be happening from other providers, and you need to keep that in mind.
Senator Solon.
Mr. Chair, I didn't have a question.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What about, how does the interaction work with the increase related to the surcharge? But the, as I understand, the Senate is also decreasing managed care premiums by 3% and Minnesota care premiums by folks 75% over poverty by 10%. And I think the financial impact of those decreases is actually even bigger than the financial impact of the House proposal. Is that, am I correct on that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Thiessen, yes, there's a the overall impact based on our preliminary analysis of the bill, the bills show that the impact would be a much higher impact of cuts from the Senate file than from the House file.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Ms. Kmit, we believe that the surcharge in the Senate bill does provide a rate increase that offsets the contribution that has been made. And, in fact, we believe in the tails that we're actually giving you back more than we should be giving you back. So we're kind of taking a look at whether we need to make a little adjustment there. In terms of the HMO reduction in managed care rates, we believe that that is justified and can be offset by the fact that the plans no longer have GMC in their book of business, and there were losses in GMC. And historically and continuously in PMAP, there have been revenues gained by the health plans. And if you no longer have GMC, either because we're doing this screwy plan that just got described earlier today, or whether we're doing the early buy-in, in either case, you don't have a GMC program in your book of business with losses.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, you're absolutely right, and we need to factor that into this. I will say, though, taken as a whole, all of these cuts, withholds, adjustments, and reductions do end up to be a net loss for the health plans. And again, the same problem exists where we have to pass it through. And that would be very difficult for a couple of the plans that don't have the ability to pass things through.
And Mr. Chair, you know, the only point I was making, Senator Berglund, you did start out talking about the impact of the financial impact on the plans. And so you can't separate out the two. You have to take them together. We are also giving them the benefit on the GMC, similar to what you're doing. So just so the record is clear, I think we need to make that point. I'm sure you're trying to make a point here, and I just wanted to make the point back.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Thiessen, I think the difference between the surcharge and a Medicaid rate cut is the Medicaid rate cut only affects those who participate in the Medicaid program. The HMO surcharge affects every plan in the state, regardless of whether they participate in the program or not.
Okay, Representative Abler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and just a couple things. I know in our committee we heard testimony from Preferred One that the surcharge would put them below the mandatory threshold for their reserves and make them unviable. And that was, I think, the Ms. Commit referenced that at least tangentially. And that's something to keep in mind, which is probably a negative thing. We'd miss them if they were gone. And that's not the intent of the bill, I know. But on the rates and all, I mentioned last night, it would be interesting, especially as we get closer to kind of a package, to see how the interaction goes. And I have to admit, I never thought about the negative, the positive impact losing GAMC in your book of business, which actually undermines one of my points, which I didn't like you doing that. But so that was, I think they mentioned losing, what, $30 million? Or wasn't that something on the order of that? That there was, or at least there was a significant loss to that thing, which is now not there, which I think gives us some room to argue that one of the points of both the points you're hearing. But if that's passed on to providers, if it's absorbed by the plans who had to absorb that plan, that would be one thing. But if it gets passed on to providers where, as I mentioned last night, we're going to wind up with a system that nobody chooses to participate in as a provider.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Abler, the language of the Senate bill says that the plans cannot pass it on to the providers. Okay.
Got to like that language. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And Madam Chair, or Senator Berglund, that makes it even more difficult because we aren't able to pass it through. Somehow it has to get passed through. If it can't get passed through to providers to share in that part of that burden, it has to get passed through to the people who purchase insurance.
Senator
Mr. Chairman and Ms. Commit, I believe that the 3% reduction is still leaving the plans actuarially sound. So it doesn't need to be passed on to anybody.
Mr. Chair and Senator Berglund, you know, we haven't confirmed that with DHS. We would like to have more discussions with DHS to see if they find that to be actuarially sound or not. At this point, we don't know.
Representative Abler.
Not to belabor, just to kind of follow up while you're here. If you could just remind us how much the plans did lose in GAMC book of business. Do you have, it was significant. It was in the tens of millions, right? Just the rough numbers, good enough for
now. Yeah, I'm sorry, I don't have it at my fingertips. I think you're right, it is roughly $30 million.
And Madam Chair, and my point about that is that, actually, Ms. Commit, who wound up paying for that then, the $30 million that you lost? Where'd that come from?
Ms. Commit.
Mr. Chair and Representative Abler, that comes out of the health plan reserves. I mean, it comes out of reserves, and that's a government program, and it also gets, it comes out of reserves. I can have one of the health plans come up and speak more directly to that.
This GAMC they were talking about?
Yeah, the GAMC negatives. Yeah,
they make money on the other public programs.
So, Madam Chair, I believe
Mr.
That.
Chair.
The chair, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Danette Coleman, I represent Medica, and Representative Thiessen, to your point. The losses in GAMC actually were offset by government programs as a whole. So when we contract with DHS, they look at the totality of the program, and the budgeting is somewhat based on that. So it doesn't come directly out of the reserves, just to clarify.
Mr. Chair, so is there a firewall then between that and your commercial accounts? So you never would draw if you had a bad year, you wouldn't pass it on to somebody else?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Abler, I mean, we have, as far as the entity, I mean, we are a single entity. We do our accounting is differentiated between our government programs and our commercial programs. However, no, it's not required by law to be like a Chinese wall. We have one set of reserves that works for both of our programs. So as there's losses or gains in one side or the other, we're a single financial entity.
And that's what I thought. Mr. Chair, to my final thought to the topic, it seems I don't know if we're going to do this, but if you ever did this kind of thing, you'd want to make sure that those who had public business would, because there's some benefit to not having the GAMC thing to some of these plans. And those who didn't have that wouldn't get a benefit. They'd still be in harm's way by not having the offset. So just Preferred One doesn't have any of this business, as I understand, right? They only have commercial stuff. And so they would get the surcharge and not get any payback if there ever would be a payback, which disappeared last night. So thank you.
We're very aware of that.
Thanks.
Thank you for your testimony, and we're going to have Tom Lehman talk about county-based purchasing and how they would be affected by this.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, I have a handout that if one of the pages can distribute provides a small amount of information. Based on who the county-based purchasing plans are, we don't have the accounting departments to produce sophisticated runs. But in short, the three county-based health plans are three health plans that serve 28 counties all outstate. We've done some preliminary work. Again, we don't have a lot of internal staff resources, but it appears that the cumulative effect of the proposals that came into this conference for South Country Health Alliance and Prime West both is about $10 million. For Itasca Care, which serves four counties in northern Minnesota, it's several million dollars. Again, I won't belabor the point, but county-based purchasing plans serve only public programs. You're familiar with the challenge that we don't have ability to pass that through to commercial payers. So they, and some of the proposals pending here before you, require them to absorb the cuts. They only have two ways to deal with that, really: staff layoffs or burn up their reserves. They don't have a lot of reserves. You're familiar with county-based purchasing and the fact that they're county-owned. The reserves, the profits, have gone back into social services, into transportation, into to other services related to the needs of the enrollees. At least one of the three county-based purchasing plans would not be able to survive the proposals before you. The only alternative they have is to, after they burn up their reserves, is turn to their local counties. But you're familiar with the challenges counties are facing, and the counties don't have a lot of extra cash on hand to underwrite the losses that you're proposing for county-based purchasing here. So we would respectfully ask you to look at alternatives to allow this alternative model to continue. County-based purchasing has worked very well. It's created some very creative partnerships between county social services staff, transportation staff, housing staff, and the health folks in the counties. It's worked well. The HEDIS scores show that Prime West had the highest HEDIS scores in the state, better than any of the commercial plans. The quality is better. The immunization rates are better, et cetera. Their administrative costs are lower. But because they're so lean, they don't have those deep pockets they can fall back on with things like this. So we would ask you to just keep that in mind, and hopefully we can resolve this in a way that doesn't force them to perhaps cease operations and services. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Lehman, isn't it true that even county-based purchasing benefits from not having GMC have to be part of their book of business?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bergman, maybe some benefits, but when you look at the net effects of everything they're facing, that doesn't keep them going.
Senator Bergman.
If you'd like to provide some additional relief in addition to the GMC, we would be welcome and happy to take that. But just the GMC alone is not going to keep plans that will otherwise be insolvent because of the surcharges, the premium cuts, the withholds, the variety of things that have been proposed. They just can't do it.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Lehman, we've looked very carefully at the payback to county-based purchasing under the Senate plan. And as a whole, they are getting back what they contribute. Now, you know, if there is a county-based purchasing plan that's kind of financially shaky anyway, I mean, that is, you know, we're not here to kind of, this mechanism doesn't allow us to be able to take that into consideration.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bergman, we understand that, but let me make myself clear. One is under the cuts proposed in this plan, one is very seriously threatened. The other two, which have been financially very vibrant and solvent, one has been in existence 20, 25 years in northern Minnesota. The other two would also be threatened. This is much beyond their current financial status. The threats are very significant to those plans and for the 28 counties that serve thousands of enrollees in Senator Lori's districts, Senator Sharon's district, Senator Dill's district, and others. They're very nervous. They're very scared. They feel very threatened by what's being discussed here and considered here this afternoon.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank
members.
You, Mr. Lehman. And we're going to have one more person, and then we're going to go into recess and George Hoffman is here, and he's here to address the certified public expenditure issue. So, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I sent an email about a week ago to both of the fiscal analysts telling them that the department's position was that based on the data that we had from Hennepin County Med Center and from Regions, that we would not be able to anticipate more than $20 million a year in federal dish revenue. And further, that with the MA expansion combined with that, that we would not be able to claim anything. And that is the position I encourage the department to take. Subsequently, we got additional information from Hennepin County Med Center's CPA on their 2008 data, estimating that they had about $55 million in countable losses based on the 2008 data, and putting this side by side with the region's data, which was about $11 million in countable losses, and that new information, since it added up to about $66 million a year in countable losses, we decided that would be sufficient to justify the approximately $33 million a year that was being claimed in federal dish, but still with the limitation that with the MA expansion, those amounts would be totally wiped out. Now let me explain that this is a technical issue, and there are federal technical requirements about claiming dish. And one of the oddities of these requirements is that when you look the losses that we're talking about, the claimable losses, are hospital costs. They're not hospital charges. They're an estimate of hospital costs for the groups on public programs that are served by the hospital and for uninsured who are served by the hospital. And so in calculating losses, what they do is they take the charges for that group and apply a cost-to-charge ratio and estimate costs based on the cost-to-charge ratio. But as I started to say, we have to subtract, they have to subtract public program revenue, they have to subtract Medicaid revenue, but they don't have to count other state public program revenue that has no federal share in it against the losses. So, for example, they can count as GAMC losses their estimated cost for the GAMC population, and they don't have to subtract the GAMC payments from the state. And those GAMC losses are 80% of what they are counting as countable losses for DISH. Now, what happens when we do a Medicaid expansion instead of GAMC is now they have to count the revenue, and in very simple terms, they don't have the equivalent of the GAMC losses anymore. They're gone. And based on our estimates in the expansion, we're going to pay them higher rates under medical assistance than they got under GAMC. And so the revenue they're going to have to count is not only equal to the GAMC revenue, it's going to be greater. Something parallel happens with their historical state-only Minnesota care payments. They haven't had to count the state-only Minnesota care payments as revenue, but they've been able to count the cost. And so that, too, is going to turn into a Medicaid payment or a medical assistance payment. And then they will see less uninsured because of the Medicaid expansion. And that will be additional, that will be a reduction in their uninsured losses. Hennepin County CPA estimated that if GAMC is turned into medical assistance, their estimated $55 million in losses will turn into less than $10 million in losses. And we think that she underestimated what they would get in medical assistance revenue. She didn't attempt to estimate what would happen to uninsured losses. But I think it's obvious that uninsured losses would be a lot less. And so it to me, it seems overwhelmingly obvious that with an MA expansion, there won't be any claimable losses left.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Hoffman, first of all, I'd like to correct one thing you said that I know for sure is an error, and that is that we only got this email from you today. And I just have to say that, you know, with only a little over 24 hours to finish this conference committee, that is a bit of a problem. The second thing I'd like to say is are not the losses that are claimed against CPEs for DSH purposes based on the prior year? So even if we got a Medicaid buy-in in the law this year, that then the losses that had been incurred in the previous year would still be good for claiming 1 year of DSH revenue?
Mr. Hoffman.
Madam Chair, I think there were two emails. And the one with the $20 million figure was approximately a week ago, and I sent a second one yesterday, I think, about the $33 million. I didn't think to bring these, but as for the prior year, I think those can only be used on an interim basis, and I think, though I'm not sure, I think you have to reconcile to actual hospital experience.
Well,
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Hoffman, it seems to me that the way that it has worked in the past is that it's always been claimed off the previous year, and then the next year is claimed off of that previous year, so I don't know that there's ever been any reconciliation that's occurred in this process.
Mr. Hoffman.
I would have to check on that, Madam Chair. We for an extended, our current forecast doesn't have any CPE in it because the department has been unable to get Hennepin to assure us that there was any to be claimed. And the latest communication from Hennepin County Med Center's CPA is hedged around with all sorts of cautions that she's really not sure this is right. And so we don't feel a lot of confidence in what has been presented with the sort of cautions you see at the end of an actuarial letter.
Mr. Godfrey.
Mr. Chair, I'd just like to address a few things. One, in terms of the reporting of past CPEs to the department, it was only recently in October that we were requested by the department to actually submit a cost report for 2007 in order to have the state claim DSH. And that's because prior to that point, they only needed our CPEs in one quarter in 2007. And so we were unable to get that cost report to them until February. My understanding is we have sent that cost report to the department. The disclaimers that our CPA has made regarding cost data has only been around the 2008 calendar year estimates that we've sent to the department to estimate what could be drawn down in CPEs. And I'm still having some difficulty digesting the analysis in that provided here today, in that it seems what's happening is we're submitting basically cost data from 2008, and that's being projected into the future and kind of held static for 12 and 13, while you're putting on top of that analysis what a projection is of the impact of Medicaid expansion in 12 and 13, something that hasn't occurred yet. It seems to me that the department, a more maybe accurate way to do this would be to project what HCMC's costs and uncompensated care would be for 12 and 13 and project, I mean, have an actual projection or estimate for 12 and 13 rather than just kind of holding the 08 assumption static. And then combine that analysis with what the projection is of the impact on Medicaid expansion. I mean, essentially, if it's assumed that HCMC doesn't have any CPEs to claim in 2012, that essentially means we have no uncompensated care and no underpayment. And believe me, I would love that to be the case, but I find that highly unlikely that that will occur. And so I just think that perhaps there's other ways to estimate this than what the department's suggesting. And, you know, even with federal health care reform, it's been mentioned or it's been stated that only up to 95% of the, total population will be insured. We're still going to have that 5% that doesn't have insurance for one reason or another. And those people are going to disproportionately show up at places like HCMC and Regions.
Senator Lurie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Hoffman. Also, the CPE to claim DISH, I mean, the bottom line is that there is about $33 million a year in DISH monies available to us if we can put up a demonstration that the non-federal was expended. And the only reason we went to HCMC and Region and limited it to that is because it was easy and they had plenty. But, I mean, isn't the category of hospital that we're talking about non-state governmental hospitals? I mean, isn't it a broader range of hospitals? Couldn't we construct some other type of mechanism getting to a broader set of hospitals and work a little harder to make sure that we get any federal dollars that are on the table?
Mr. Hoffman.
As far as I know, we only have federal approval to count CPEs from Hennepin and Regions. I don't know to what extent, I don't know how many other publicly owned hospitals there are who could qualify for the CPE. So I don't know the answer to that question.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Lurie. Senator Lurie.
Sorry. Excuse me. I would think it'd be a worthwhile question to ask. I mean, I think our county-run facilities throughout the state would be able to, you know, add something to the pot. And, you know, I mean, if there's federal DISH money sitting on the table and we just got to demonstrate that we've lost money and that we have hospitals, we, you know, in these tight times, we should be able to demonstrate that if we get a little bit creative.
It is a very technical and very there are new federal regulations about this, and there is a complicated accounting process which Hennepin Med Center has not gone through yet. And so this is still why they're, even with what they tell us, there is some uncertainty about where the ultimate numbers are going to end up.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Hoffman, I understand that the department some time ago put in a request to the federal government to allow us to use our Minnesota Care payments that are not under Medicaid to claim DISH. Is that true?
Mr. Hoffman.
I believe that's true, Madam Chair. At least that was planned. I don't know that it's been submitted.
And yes. What is the calculation that would draw down in addition to the CPEs that Hennepin and Ramsey have in terms of being able to claim the full DISH allotment?
Mr. Hoffman.
It would draw against the same amounts. Those amounts are the only amounts available, and we can only claim them one way or another. And so it would not be a matter of additional amounts.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Hoffman, I understand that, but when you're doing it through CPEs, you only get to claim whatever has happened at Hennepin and Regions Hospital in terms of Minnesota Care. The Minnesota Care other business in the rest of the state would claim more dollars than we could claim through a CPE mechanism with Hennepin and Regions. And so I'm just wondering if anybody has figured out what that would be.
Mr. Hoffman.
It's my understanding what we asked to do was to count all Minnesota Care hospital payments the same way we were claiming all GAMC fee-for-service hospital payments. And the hitch in that is that almost all of Minnesota Care payments are in the form of managed care, and we were unable in the past to get the federal agency to approve our claiming GAMC hospital payments made through managed care. And so there was, and I think is, still considerable uncertainty about whether or not the federal government will approve that. But I believe it was all hospital payments.
Senator Bergman.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Hoffman, I can't believe that you would have gone to the trouble to apply for a waiver for this if you didn't think you were going to get some benefit from it.
Mr. Hoffman.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, after the GAMC veto, as has been pointed out, we faced the prospect of money on the table, and even though I don't think the department thought the prospects were overwhelmingly good, we decided to make the effort and to see if we could take advantage of the DISH funds that way. As you know, a different federal administration, and we sometimes get different answers under a new administration from what we got under the old administration.
Okay, well, thank you both for your testimony, and I do have one other person that I would like to have testify in another matter, and that's from the Department of Corrections. Barb Cox. She's getting her notes. And maybe she testifies today. You can spend tomorrow where young mothers should spend their time on Mother's Day.
The rest of us?
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I'm Barbara Cox from the Department of Corrections, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify. I guess I'd like to start by saying that the provision that the Senate included in their bill has been introduced a couple of times, and we would like the Senate to know and policymakers that we understand how strongly the Senate feels about this and that this program, in their opinion, since it's being provided in the prison, should be funded by corrections dollars. So we recognize the intent. We understand the intent. We entered into this interagency agreement with the Department of Human Services because the goal of the program is to avert civil commitments, which would in turn decrease budget responsibilities for the Department of Human Services. And all treatment, we think, is good in the prison system because offenders that are occupied are better offenders to manage and safer for our staff. Having said that, should this program be discontinued, because that's a lower priority for policymakers than the other very, very tough decisions that you have to make, we would just ask that the conference committee direct the Department of Human Services to do some higher priority with that money and to be silent on the Department of Corrections, because the language as drafted does not seem to have the option of discontinuing the program and therefore not having the option of transferring the money that then goes into our base. If we are required to transfer this money every year, we would have to take that money from other treatment, from CD treatment, from education, from sex offender treatment at other facilities, and we don't think that that's a good outcome either.
Any questions for Senator Berglund?
Ms. Cox, don't you think that the Department of Corrections should at least pay for some of the cost of providing treatment to these offenders?
Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, I think that the department treats a very small percentage of the sex offenders that come to prison, and the department in better budget times would like to treat many more. So yes, we agree that treatment is a value for those offenders that may be released. It's a value to public safety. However, we don't have the funds right now to pay for it. So in our opinion, the policy isn't at hand is whether or not this program should be funded as it currently is, because the department just simply does not have the funds to cover new program costs.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, and Ms. Cox, maybe as you've been sitting here, maybe you've been noticing that we're having the same problem.
Madam Chair, I hear you. This is an incredibly different situation, and we understand, and as I've been talking to conferees, I'll echo what I have said in the past couple days, which is if policymakers believe that there are higher priorities than sex offender treatment for offenders that may be civilly committed, we absolutely understand that that money may get redirected elsewhere, but that would be the funding that's currently coming from the Department of Human Services.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Ms. Cox, initially in your statement you said that the agreement was entered into with the Department of Human Services because of a hope that there would be fewer people civilly committed. Have there been fewer people civilly committed?
Madam Chair, Representative Huntley, I am not the best person to speak to this issue, but I do have some information from the Department of Human Services. Would you like to speak to that? And I'll defer to Ms. Brandt.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon, conferees and Mr. Chair. My name is Dr. Sheila Brandt, and I'm the Legislative and Stakeholder Relations Director for the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. And I see that you have the information about the...
I have not distributed this.
You have not? Okay, it's just for my reference. Thank you. And I guess I'm here to speak to some of the question that you raised about whether or not there have been individuals or a significant number of individuals diverted from civil commitment as a result of this joint MSOP DOC program. I think when I've spoke with each of you individually, and I've also sent information to various conferees in this group, as well as when we've talked about this program as a matter of policy, I would say that the data is promising, but that it's premature. In looking at the individuals who've been through the program, there have been a total of 236 individuals who've been admitted since the program opened. Of that, there have been 23 individuals that the county did not proceed with commitment. Now, it's difficult for us to know statistically what the reasons for the refusal or the reason the county did not proceed with commitment was. In addition, there were another six individuals who simply were not forwarded for commitment because when the DOC reviewed their risk factors towards the end of the confinement review, they didn't meet the threshold to be sent to the counties for a review. So the benchmarks that have been put in place, one of them, of course, is diversion from civil commitment. The second issue would be related to, is this program effective in that if people are pre-treated, do they progress through the program more quickly than if they had come simply from DOC or elsewhere and then been civilly committed? We do have at least one case where an individual came from that program and went to, directly down to St. Peter to our transitional program. That's of note because although it's only one individual, it should be noted that this program's only, the transitional aspect, has only been up and running for 2 years. So we can't have lengthier data on how significant it is in people moving that much more quickly along the program track.
Senator Bergman.
Mr. Chairman, how many individuals that had been referred for commitment previous to this program were not committed or not forwarded for commitment?
Madam Chair, I don't have the referral numbers in front of me. I will get you that information. As you know, there was a big spike in referrals after the tragic events of some years ago. But I think that what Ms. Brandt was talking about is that the research shows that in the 2 years that this has been in place with a recent change of staffing, that there has, in fact, been an impact under the circumstances that exist and the amount of referrals that exist right now.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, without having that information, we really can't tell whether we've had any impact on referrals or not, can we? If we don't know what was happening before we were in this joint arrangement with the Department of Human Services to compare to, we don't really know if this is an improvement or if it's a status quo or if it's even a worse outcome than we had previously.
Ms. Cox.
Madam Chair, I agree that you need that critical piece of information. However, at this point, what's most important to the department is that we do not take from our existing staff and our existing programs. So again, it's a greater priority for us that our existing critical functions not be reduced than to preserve this program. And again, I'm speaking for the Department of Corrections, not for the Department of Human Services. But because the program is new, because the program is premature, we would prefer for the program to be discontinued, perhaps while the legislative auditor conducts his study and is able to bring more information back to the legislature on a broad range of issues related to MSOP.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, the goal of the Senate isn't to discontinue the program. The goal of the Senate is to get the Department of Corrections to be fiscally responsible for their own inmates, at least in part. I mean, we are cutting a lot of other essential services in the area of human services. So don't feel like you're the only ones that are struggling to make your budget work for you. And when we're cutting child care, we're cutting chemical dependency providers that might not survive to treat people in the community who have not been committed to the Department of Corrections, one has to ask oneself if it isn't time for this partnership to start being a true partnership.
Madam Chair, members, I will note that the interagency agreement that establishes this program expires at the end of this fiscal year. And as I started by saying, we hear what the Senate is saying, that you want this done differently, that you want the department to consider paying part of it. And speaking, again, just for the Department of Corrections, if the program were to discontinue because of higher priorities that policymakers have for this budget cycle, that would be our intent.
Just a comment, and obviously we don't know, and the research can't tell us yet, but if there were 29 individuals that were not sent to MSOP, that's 29 times about $300 a day times 365 days. It's a lot of money.
Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, we have no way to know whether we're really saving any money or not here. And, you know, just from the true meaning of the word partnership, usually when you're in a partnership, both organizations at least contribute something to the partnership. I see this partnership all being one way.
Representative Hosh had his hand up first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just out of curiosity, I was wondering if the department can recall what their departmental cut was in the public safety omnibus bill.
Ms. Cox.
Representative Hosh, members of the committee, the department has been cut in total about 1.5%, which we recognize is lower than human services agencies.
Representative Abler.
Thanks. I just, maybe related to that, it'd be interesting just to know, I mean, is this, as we flesh these out, what impact that amount of money would have on what you do. But the other part, it occurs to me, if this goes away, we forever worry about if there's a legal challenge to some of the things we're doing with these sex offenders and the civil commitment and all that. It seems like there's an inoculation effect that would be beneficial to keep this program going, hoping that it's beneficial. That here we are trying to keep them out of civil commitment. So we made a big effort, and they had some treatment and a chance for the ones who could get better to not have to go. And so it seems that I just wanted to raise that point as a reason to maybe want to continue it. I hope there is some baseline data that would be interesting. But even if there weren't, it seems like we did want to make it work, so it worked. But the risk we have in all these, this whole pot of business, is that the way judges decide things sometimes, you could have a whole bunch of them turn loose because they weren't deemed to be, they already served their penalty. So that's
Senator Berglund and then Representative Thiessen.
Mr. Chairman, just so it is clear what the Senate proposal is, our proposal is only to discontinue funding for chemical dependency this biennium. And the next biennium, it is for the Department of Corrections to take over the cost of this program. And if they feel that they don't have enough money to do it, they can always ask the legislature in the next biennium to increase the appropriations for this. But if we don't do anything here, we're just going to keep paying for this program. We're not going to know whether we're really getting any benefit from it, and we're going to keep cutting other programs. That's how I see it.
Okay, Representative Thiessen, then we're going to recess.
Good. I guess my only point here, or my only sense here, is these aren't just in two different budgets. And in terms of partnerships, I think the question is whether, when I know that you haven't talked to Representative Paymar, this is going to affect his budget. I don't know if you've talked to the corrections folks in the Senate to find out whether they have the money. I mean, we're basically, my philosophical problem with this is that you're messing with somebody else's budget. And, you know, the agreement was signed between the departments where the Department of Human Services said they're going to send the money over to the Department of Corrections. And so if we're talking about true partnerships, it seems to me we should actually involve both committees in the decision.
Senator Berglund.
Well, Mr. Chairman, this is money that comes out of the Department of Human Services budget. This isn't money that...
Well, you can't take the position then that you're not going to be cutting the program.
I mean, this money is not... like owed to the Department of Corrections. It's not like, you know, we have a legal obligation to them. And I would say this, that, we can say, well, we can't do anything unless another committee of the legislature agrees that we stop giving them our money. But then we have to make another decision that affects somebody else within our budget area. And I don't think another committee of the legislature exactly understands that we're in that predicament.
And, Mr. Chair, I don't disagree with anything you said, except for the fact that you can't take the position that we're not going to cut the program and then we're going to cut the money without talking to the other side. And that's the position. So it's an inconsistent position, and that's all I want to, I mean, which I think is true.
Mr. Chairman, just one last comment, and that is this interagency agreement was entered into without notification of the legislature or putting the item in a budget for a budget decision to be made. It was made by the Department of Human Services, and then it was just folded into the budget like as if these were people that were committed to the state of Minnesota. And I don't think that was appropriate either.
Okay, well, thank you for your testimony, and we're now going to go into recess.
For how long?
TBD.
What's our recess about here? Explain this to me.
Time.
I wish you would have said recess
we're
until when.
You guys were. Yeah.